The Lima Coast to Coast, Show 41, May 29th, 2007. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before getting into the show, I want to remind listeners there are numerous ways to get in touch with me. The first is via email, podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. The next is via the website at www.thelemacoasttocoast.com. Next is physical mail, and you can write me at Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A, 30065, and that's in the USA. Also, there is a voicemail, area code 206-600-5782. And there are other ways like the MySpace page at www.myspace.com/ThelemaCoastToCoast. You can search for Thelema Coast to Coast on Frapper, or you can go to the website and click on the Frapper map. And, of course, I still have the ongoing promotion of send a postcard to the show at Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, etc. And I will send you a Thelema Coast to Coast sticker. I have about 50 of those left, so they're going quickly. So, the obvious aspect of the show is that it hasn't been out in 2 months. So, yeah. I appreciate all of the emails that people have been sending, saying how they like the show and that they're looking forward to the next podcast coming out. Well, here it is. And basically what's going on is I'm going through some significant changes in my life. I talked about it in the last podcast. I've finished my undergraduate degree, and now I'm going to be going to grad school in Europe in about 2.5 months. I'm going to be moving to Amsterdam in mid-August. So if there are any Amsterdam listeners out there, send me an email, because I would love to get together and say hi in mid-August. I'm probably going to be in Amsterdam around August 17th or 18th, somewhere around there. It's still kind of tentative, but that's about the time I'm going to be there. So that has some significant implications on the podcast. I'm not sure where the podcast is going to go. I'm going to keep releasing them as I can until I go. So that means for June and July. And then from there, I don't know how it's going to progress. It might come out when it comes out. I might stop it altogether. That was actually my initial thought, to stop it altogether. But I'm not sure that's what I'm going to do. I don't know. One thing that will be changing is the website will be changing. I'm going to change it from kind of a forum-based site. I'm just going to get a simple hosting plan, and I'm going to move it over to WordPress. The feed will still be the same, so you don't need to update any of your RSS feed catchers or anything. But I'm going to kind of remove the forums and that kind of interactivity and stuff. I'm still going to have the postcards listed. I'm still going to have links to the various sponsors and or MySpace, etc. But I'm going to be removing a lot of the username password. That stuff just isn't used that much, and everything in that CMS is based on ASP, and I want to move to a simpler CMS system. So, hang in there and keep the feed. I will definitely be putting stuff out for the next 2 months, and then starting in August and September. I'm not sure how things are going to change, but, hang in there with me, and I'll do what I can, and I definitely will keep you informed with my thoughts as we progress. All right, so that's kind of where things are at. Since the podcast has been on hiatus for about 2 months, I decided to have an extra long podcast. So this one's going to be about 2 hours. I know that's a larger download, but lots of listening fun. So on today's show, I have an interview with John Sewell. He is producing The Rite of Venus in Seattle, and he was on the show before when he was talking about his Rite of Luna. So we have him back on talking about his newest production, Crowley's Rite of Venus. Then I have about a half an hour discussion with Keith 418 about leadership and the OTO, the Thelemic community, and many other kind of subjects and tangents from that. And then lastly, I have an interview with Frater W.I.T. He's written a book called Enochian Initiation, and he and I talk a lot about the book, you know, some technical aspects of Enochian, personal preferences, ideological basis of approaching magical work, a number of things like that. So it's actually a very interesting interview, and it touches on a lot of different things. So before getting into that, I want to get into the listener feedback. I received, like I said, a tremendous amount of emails of just support and well wishes and congratulations on 2 years and so forth. So thanks to all of those. But I've got three emails I'm going to read and four voicemails. I think it's four. So I'm going to jump into the email first, and then I'll do the voicemails. The first one is from listeners Peter and Christina. They're down in Australia. They say, we've been listening to your podcast for a while now. Together with my lady, I found them to be very open and informative. Keep up the good work. And I know that you will have many fans here in Australia. My lady and I run a magical temple registered as Order of Obsidian here in Australia. We follow Thelema and use Crowley's work in much of what we do. Unfortunately, the OTO is not well represented here in Australia, other than by a few of those whose main interest is in making financial profit rather than encouraging spiritual and magical knowledge and teaching such. Once again, many thanks for the podcast and for the efforts you are putting into the work, Peter and Christina. Well, I'm sorry to hear that is your impression of the Australian OTO. I know there's a number of mixed opinions. There's lots of people out there who think that the Australian OTO is doing a really good job, and obviously there's some who don't. And maybe that's something that the OTO will look at and how it's being perceived and how it's operating in Australia. I don't know. I'm here in the States, so I have no opinion about it whatsoever. If any other Australian listeners are out there and want to make comments, feel free to email and or leave voicemail. All right. The next one is from a listener named Doshinto. And he writes, I enjoy the show for the most part, John, but I can't stand Keith 418's whining all the time. His voice is so irritating. I feel like cringing. Does he have to be so emotional and indignant? If he hates the order so much, why doesn't he just let it go? Well, Doshinto, I think you have the wrong impression of Keith's attitude about the order. I think it's actually quite the opposite. He doesn't hate the order. He loves the order, and he hates seeing what the current leadership is doing to the order and how they're really ruining it in many ways. And so that's why he and I talk about the things that are going wrong in the OTO and how it's hurting the order and the Thelemic community. And if you don't like his voice, I'm sorry. There's not much he can do about that. And if you really don't like his message and everything, it's an MP3. Feel free to fast forward over it. All right. The next email is from William. I have to compliment you on the quality of your show. I've downloaded them all from iTunes, and I'm working my way from the oldest to the newest. Episode 23 was fantastic, and for reasons that might surprise you, you answered an email from Will about when do I start doing my rituals. You answered now, and went into an explanation of how important it is to do the work right away. Get started. Then you went into a detailed explanation of the uses of the magical journal. Well, that advice hit me right where I was in terms of my spiritual work and how I'd been goofing off. Within an hour, I'd started my own journal and was getting my practice organized. Then you had a conversation with Keith 418 about the mentor-student relationship, one of the best explanations of the phenomenon I've ever heard. It was clear, mature, practical, and reasonable. Some of the simplest and most useful wisdom on an important subject I've ever heard. I would recommend this episode to anyone working in any spiritual path, and I mean any. You see, I'm not a Thelemite. I'm not a pagan. I'm not even an occultist. I'm a practicing Christian with a slight mystical bent whose path is, in most ways, orthodox and mainstream. Yet the wisdom of that episode was so wise and deep and practical that it hit me right where I needed to be hit, overriding any differences of spiritual path. Many thanks for a great resource. I will continue to listen and learn. Blessings, William. Well, William, thank you very much for listening to the show. I'm glad that was very useful. And I think you hit upon something that's really important. The unique is actually universal. What we talk about when we talk about the OTO or the Thelemic community actually has implications that are wide-reaching. Our criticisms or observations about the order are also criticisms and observations about the nation and the national government or any organization. I hear from pagans all the time saying the issues that we discuss and that the OTO has are also issues within the pagan community. And I would assume that there are issues within all religious communities. And our criticisms of modernity are very wide-reaching. And our discussions of class obviously have implications everywhere, not just within the OTO. So when you look at practice and when you look at theory and you discuss those topics, they definitely have wide-reaching implications. So thank you for sending the email, William, and pointing that out and reminding us. And I hope you keep listening and send more feedback in the future. All right, now we're going to move into the voicemail. The first one is from a listener named, I think it was Sor Ren.
Hi, John. This is Sor Ren. I'm calling about the interview you had with Keith 418 about the inavailability of the currently published works. And I just had a few comments on that. The first comment I want to make is that people don't want to buy it anymore. It's all old public domain stuff. Anyone who wants any of the old Crowley texts can just go to sacredtext.com and download whatever they want. They don't have to go to a bookstore. They don't have to wait. So the OTO, in that sense, isn't going to be selling to new people or isn't going to be attracting anyone new, only people who know what this is. Someone who does a random Google search on Aleister Crowley is going to pull up all these texts, whereas if you go to a bookstore or even if a book do a random Google search on magic, they're going to come with all this stuff or occultism or whatever. People aren't going to do that at a bookstore. It's more of a waste of time to do. The people who are going to buy it already have it. Second of all, Thelema is not Crowley. You know, who cares about some obscure letters that he's got published out there, or who cares that, you know, some certain object, some certain document isn't published or whatever. I'd rather see new artworks by other people besides Crowley, like, you know, more works by OTO members such as Juan Milo or Kim Wasserman or whoever. And really, I'd rather see them spending the money to interest new people than sell people, you know, another collection of Crowley's sex diaries, you know. You can look at the way a Christian church would handle it. They don't make their money or whatever by selling copies of the Bible over again to the same people. They do it by, you know, giving their congregants something worth their time, which in my mind, I think that you know, another book isn't what it is. You know, if the OTO wants to make money, you know, hold more events, you know, attract new members, make every event that people go to memorable, you know, give them something worth their money. Don't, you know, just throw a book out there. Just reading. The magic is in the person, not in the text. Love is the law of Underworld.
Well, thank you very much for sending that voicemail. Well, obviously, I pretty much disagree with everything you say, but that's okay. And I'm going to tell you why, though. First of all, the attitude that the books are all online really ignores the issue of quality. Most of the books that are online, the texts are poorly typeset and or they are full of errors. Now, I will note that there is a project by the OTO, and one particular brother in comes to mind who is actually working to make PDF versions that counteract this, and I think his efforts should be applauded. But in general, especially on sacredtext.com, those are no replacements for books. They are incomplete. The books that are put out by the OTO, HB has to be commended on his scholarship and research. You know, there have been some gaffes in the past, but in general, the annotations, the indexes, and things like that are a huge addition. And to think that you can just pull up the text and do word searches and things like that, and that's the equivalent of an index, is to really not understand what an index is about. Second, I don't think it's a waste of time. Books are a physical manifestation of ideology. And if you disagree with that, look at the numbers. There are more books coming out every year than all the previous years before. If we were going to move towards a paperless society, we're actually going in the opposite direction. So we're doing something wrong. The means of technology have allowed us to produce more books, not less, and more people are getting their words out on the written page. And that's where it has substantial meaning. You look at anybody within the printing industry or the media industry, and they don't consider a web edition or a book edition the same thing. A book edition actually has a lot more weight, and it has a lot more, well, literal weight, but it also has a lot more gravitas within people's ideas. If someone's going to spend the time and put it on paper and spend the money, obviously it's more meaningful. Now, to address your Thelema is not Crowley, I think that is a silly statement that I hear quite frequently. That's like saying Christianity isn't Jesus or Paul, or that Muslims don't need Muhammad, or that the Buddha has nothing to do with Buddhism. You can't remove the founder from the spirituality or the system. If you do, the system becomes meaningless. If you take Crowley out of Thelema, Thelema doesn't really mean anything. It's just now your personal collection, your hodgepodge of whatever spiritual practices you want. If you want to do that, that's fine. More power to you. But don't call it Thelema. Thelema needs Crowley. Crowley is the glue that binds it all together. And you talk about people like Duquette and Wasserman putting out books. Now, I've had Duquette on the show multiple times, and I think he has done really good work. But the reality is, everything that he does builds on Crowley. He quotes Crowley, he references Crowley, he annotates Crowley, he builds on Crowley's work. Even his My Life in Spirits is a biography of him doing the work that Crowley recommended. You go to Jim Wasserman, what is Wasserman doing? He's editing, or he's introducing, or he's working with the works of Crowley and Crowley's students. You're going to have a hard time having anything to do with Thelema and not have it reference back to Crowley. Similarly, you reference a Christian church and what they're doing. I would love for you to show me a Christian church that doesn't have Jesus centered within their work. And all of the books that they put out always have references back to the scriptures of Jesus Christ. So therefore, it's not surprising when you look at Thelemic books, they always have references back to Aleister Crowley. Again, Crowley is the glue that binds Thelema together. You take Crowley out, you don't have Thelema. You just have whatever. Now, you're saying, is it worth the time? I would have to say yes. Books are very much worth the time. You can't go and learn what you can from a book from being in a social community. You can't even do that in a class. If that was the case, you wouldn't have to read books in school. You could just go and the teacher would give you information. Books allow information to be presented in a consistent, in-depth, portable way. Something that reading online is less apt to do. Also, I don't think the OTO is interested in making money. If it was, it would actually be out there producing books, releasing books, and also asking the members for more money so that they could do those endeavors. But they're not. In fact, it's afraid to ask people for money. So I don't think the OTO is interested in making money. Now, you say that the OTO should make its events more memorable. I have no problems with that. But you have to remember, memorability comes from meaning. If the event is meaningful, people will remember it. And what makes the things memorable or meaningful is that it has some kind of connection to their spirituality and or their needs. So again, that goes back to what Thelema is about. If they are a Thelemic group, and that could be questionable with the way the leaders are moving the OTO away from Crowley, but nevertheless, Crowley is what holds it all together, and the events are becoming less and less memorable because they are moving away from Crowley and Crowley's ideas and Crowley's writings and things like that. And as they do that, the events become less and less meaningful and become more just about a social club that is based on whatever. It's not really important what it is. It's just kind of the idea that people come around, and then it's the social thing that matters. I think that kind of idea is completely foolish, but that's the kind of garbage that people are putting out. So thank you for sending your email and bringing this discussion up. Again, I completely disagree with you, but it's good to have a variety of opinions stated on the show. The next email is from a listener named Freighter Controversy.
93, John. This is Freighter Controversy from Buffalo, New York. I called today to thank you for a wonderfully educational 2 years. I have enjoyed your podcast, and I thank you for keeping it alive amongst the many changes in your personal life. I found your talk with Keith 418 in podcast number 40 about the books going out of print to be extremely frustrating and incredibly maddening. This is yet one more example of how the current leadership is damaging instead of building the order. Until they take what they themselves do seriously, how can they honestly expect the community to take them seriously? Best of luck to you, John, as you finish your studies, move forward with your publishing business, and your move to Europe. Thanks once again for keeping the podcast alive. It is greatly appreciated. Love is the law, love under will.
Thank you very much for your comments and sending that in. As the last caller's comments, I agree with you that it is unfortunate that the Order is not putting the books out. And it seems sometimes we're beating that dead horse there. But, you know, the books are really what spread the message. And books outlive people. Ideas presented in books are eternal, or at least seem eternal. I mean, we're still talking about Plato's ideas, and those were written down, you know, millennia ago. And we have numerous other authors who wrote their ideas down in books and so forth centuries and centuries and millennium ago. So, you know, to think that the web in its ephemeral aspects can replace a book, I think is just really silly. Anyway, going to the next comment is from a listener named Neil.
Hi, John. This is Neil from Los Angeles, California. Been a long-time listener. Really asset. And I understand you mentioned in your last podcast that you were going to Europe to continue or to finish in graduate school. Well, I have a question for you. What if you, I don't know, put like together some kind of audition to continue it, what is a good thing, and I'm sure a lot of people consider, like myself, to be just, as I mentioned before, an asset. Yeah, and keep this good thing going. We could like have like a switchover like Art Bell and George Norrie. Anyway, thanks for putting on this show, and thank you. Bye.
Well, thank you very much for that comment, and I'll keep that in mind. For right now, though, I think I'm going to try and keep producing the podcast as I can, when I can, and we'll go from there. You know, the likelihood is there will be some format changes over the near future, especially once I get settled in Amsterdam. I'm going to have a different computer system there versus my large mixing board, microphone, computer, monitor, and all that. I'm going to be on a laptop, so I'm not entirely sure how that's going to play out. But nevertheless, I certainly will, you know, work to produce the best podcast I can. And if it just becomes too much, then I'll decide what to do from there. So nevertheless, thanks for the suggestion and the voicemail. All right, the next listener and the last voicemail is from someone who's posing a very different kind of question.
Hi, John. I wanted to really appreciate your show, and I hope that you'll love your studies in Europe. You know, it's going to be nice to get out of the bubble, out of the media bubble of the United States. My questions or my interests are, what, if anything, or does the OTO have to say, or people within it, to do with questions of global warming now? I mean, we're in the end of Horace and Wage, so forth. I feel like the age of force and fire, whatever you want to call it, doesn't necessarily address the possible environmental end of the world scenario that is certainly in the minds of many now, and more as time goes on. I know that might be some kind of contingent, some kind of thing off the track of our will, but I don't know. I that's something that interests me. And the other question I had to raise was, and maybe this comes along the idea of what Sarah McKenna said with the DMT and some other, like Sylvia Devorum, which are hallucinogens, which spirit, plant spirits, and other strange entities are people make contact with or see or talk with. Does that have a place within magical practice? I know these are not formalistic rituals and so forth, but I'm interested. I'm just interested in what others might have to say on this, or your own experience or knowledge of these topics. And if you could have, if you could address those, I'd appreciate it. Again, I love the show, and congratulations on so many years, podcasting and doing it so successfully, and addressing such a range of subjects, and being very serious-minded in your discussion and points and topics. So thank you very much, and love is Allah, love and the will. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Those are very different questions, and I'm glad you asked them. First, I don't think that there is a direct discussion of global warming within the OTO and or Thelema. However, that does not mean there isn't something that can be figured out from this and kind of looked at. One of the things that has gotten us into the situation about global warming is the fact that mankind sees itself separate from its environment. And therefore, we kind of look at what we do to the world around us as not affecting us, that we're some kind of integrated or separate entity from the world. And I think it's that kind of mentality that has let mankind abuse the earth around us and cause all of the environmental harm that we've done without thinking that there's going to be a direct impact. I think Thelema, and in particular the Aeon of Horus, has a different ideological stance that we're all part of the same kind of environment, that there isn't this real separation between, the outside and the inside. If you look at kind of like the play between Nuit and Harit, you know, Nuit being all of the possibilities and Harit being an individual, well, then, you know, there is this interaction between the all and the one, and to really think that there's no connection there is really kind of foolish. And so I would think that moving into the new eon and getting a more conscious idea of one's interaction with one's environment and how will can change within environment and how environment can affect the individual, that would possibly cause somebody to look at the environment differently and maybe want to engage in helping the environment more. Now, in particular to the OTO doesn't get involved in those kind of political issues. Global warming, the environment are certainly issues that are on the minds of many, many OTO members. And that kind of manifests in their own personal practice and their own work, but is not something that the OTO, as far as I'm aware, takes an official position on. And then also Thelema itself, again, that kind of discussion of global warming is not really significant within the writings of the Thelemic authors. But again, if you keep in mind how environment affects individual and individual affects environment, there definitely is a relationship there, and magic really brings that to the forefront of the mind of the practitioner. So I would think within that kind of context, global warming and the environment would become very important. Now, as for your discussions of DMT or hallucinogenic drugs and their place within the magical practice, I definitely think that there's a place for that. Curly talks about it in numerous ways about how various drugs can be used. But the difference is those drugs are used more as a sacrament or used in very specific circumstances. Instead of just, you know, going out and getting screwed up on a particular drug on a Friday night, they were done in very particular contexts within ritual results. Leading up to the use, during the use, and after the use were recorded, and things were analyzed. So I definitely think that there is an aspect to that. Now, what's interesting about your question, too, is that the last interview I have with Frater W.I.T., he has a particular interest in Timothy Leary hallucinogenic processes and the psychology involved in that. And so we discuss a little bit of the ways magic can get one in a particular mental state that is similar to hallucinogenic substances without actually going through taking the substance itself. And if I recall, Timothy Leary ultimately said that the goal was to be able to achieve those states of consciousness without actually ingesting the chemicals. Now, I'm no Leary expert, and if I'm getting that wrong, I'm certainly sure one of my listeners will correct me, and please feel free to do so. However, you know, if you read Crowley's discussion of drugs, he does see that there's a place for them. But if you use them habitually, casually, it loses the sacred nature, and it really diminishes the contribution to your magical practice. All right. That is all the listener feedback, which was a good amount, and I thank everybody for sending it. And I hope now that the podcast 41 is out that I will get some more. Also, I would really welcome people's follow-up ideas, questions, and comments to the listener feedback here. So what we're going to do is we're now going to go into the interview with John Sewell, and he is putting on the Rite of Venus in Seattle and Portland, and so he's going to talk a little bit about that. So here's John.
We have on the phone with us John Sewell. Are you there, John?
I'm here.
93, welcome to the podcast.
93.
Now, when you were last on the podcast, you were promoting a show that you were doing, the Rite of Luna. And now you are actually promoting the Rite of Venus. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about what you're doing with the Rite of Venus?
Well, the Rite of Venus, obviously one of Crowley's seven rites of Eleusis, and we have adapted it once again as a musical theater piece. This time we have included a lot more sort of a techno music and lots of belly dance and Middle Eastern themes because, you know, it's a nice flavor for Venus. We've had a great time working with it. We've worked with some really, really talented individuals, and we will be staging in Portland and Seattle, and the soundtrack's already available through our website.
All right. So the last one you did, Luna, was a rock opera.
That
and,
is correct.
A lot of kind of instrumental rock music. What kind of instrumental music are you doing now? Is it a more of an Eastern flair? You were saying kind of belly dancing, or...?
It's still rock music. What I actually did is I took traditional Middle Eastern belly dance beats, some of them 6-8 times, 7-8 times, great classic beats, and then I reprogrammed them through a drum machine and sort of used a more of a techno sound and used that as the substructure for the musical work. And then used a lot of minor chord scales to create the overall Eastern feel of it. But it's still music. It's still, a lot of it's really danceable. A lot of it's still got a real strong rock feel to it. We did a lot more vocally, too. We have a ensemble of seven vocalists who work on stage with us besides the main cast members and do some just great harmony work throughout the piece.
So instead of like in Luna where the cast members were the singers, you're also having some people involved who are just singing and not doing any acting?
Well, they're doing a little bit of the acting as well. They are probationers to the Temple of Venus, and so they have some movement and they have some stage blocking, but primarily they're rounding out the vocal work as well.
Are they kind of more like a chorus?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're doing just beautiful work. It's just amazingly talented people.
Now, you said the CD is out, so this is a studio-recorded version of all of
yes.
the music.
The studio-recorded version is already available through our website, Elusive, that's ELEUSYVE.com.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will be doing the DVD shortly after we run the show and get it edited. And I think the DVD, the sound quality is going to be even better. We've got some great audio engineers working with us on that, and so it's going to be... What we did production-wise with Luna is really going to improve with Venus because we learned so much along the way.
Right. So where are you going to be presenting it?
We will be opening in a couple of weeks in Portland, June 9th, at the Coho Theater, and Second Mont Lodge has been helping us out with that, and so kudos to them. Thanks. And then we will be coming up to Seattle for June 28th, 29th, 30th, and July 6th, 7th, and 8th. And 777 will be a special show. We have an after-party scheduled afterward and some extra stuff that night, so that's going to be a lot of fun.
That sounds fantastic. So what is your overall plan? You've done Luna. You're doing Venus. Or is the overall goal to do ultimately a theatrical production, musical production of all seven?
That is my goal, and I've decided that is my life's work. I said, okay, this is my contribution to Western culture. So the next one we'll be doing is Mercury, and we will be tying together what we did in Luna and what we're doing in Venus into a cohesive story through the three of them. And then we're probably going to jump up to the top of the tree and start with Saturn and go all the way through Sol, and then we'll have all seven. We'll release the box set, and I'll retire.
That's kind of an early retirement, don't you think? I mean, you're...
Well, it takes about 2 years apiece.
Oh, okay.
So I'm thinking I have another 10 years worth of work cut out for me, and... And, you know, if I'm retiring on the residuals from this, then I will be living in a cardboard box. but I will probably then stop doing Crowley musicals, although, you know, I may do The Ship, who knows.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, I may actually go and write something of my own.
Oh.
Who knows?
Who knows? Or, you know, there's lots of other Crowley material that could be adapted, too. And then there's other artists, too.
Well, absolutely. Although I have looked at The Ship, and I like it, so we'll
mm-hmm.
see.
Well, good. So, your website before was kind of like The Rite of Luna, and now it's a different one. Have you created a production company? I mean, it seems you're kind of seeing this in a bigger picture. The Rite of Luna was kind of this one-off thing, and now it's kind of gone into something larger?
Well, we've put together the production company mainly because we decided after Luna, you know, we should do all of these.
Mm-hmm.
Luna was well-received. People enjoyed it. We really enjoyed doing it. I mean, it's a stressful process. There's a lot of people involved and schedules and all that, but production is also really enjoyable. You get to hang out with amazingly talented people, and you're involved in a project that you're really proud of, and so it just becomes something that sort of becomes what your life is. And so we put together Elusive as our production company, I think Melissa Holm came up with the name, and we put together our website and started bringing people into the project.
Now, how many copies of The Rite of Luna have sold, the DVD?
I couldn't tell you the exact number. I don't have them in front of me, but it's over 100.
Okay.
So, considering that it's an on-demand publication, that's not bad.
That's great.
And considering that I think only 100 tickets were available when Crowley originally did The Rite of Luna,
right.
Paxton Hall, I mean, that's not bad. It's
all right.
Getting
well,
out there exponentially.
And if people have never heard about this, they can still go to the site and pick that up off the site, too. It's, as you said, it's on demand, so if people order it, they will create it.
Yep, they will. Those are available. Luna soundtracks are available. And it's interesting that as Venus has gotten closer, Luna has started selling better because people want to know what it is we do. And we got a lot of hits on our web-based promotional sites, and so it's going really well.
And also, people, when they go to your website, they can see, I guess you've during some dress rehearsals, you've recorded some scenes and have that as a preview?
Sort of video trailer, actually. We shot it, our videographer shot it for us and just put together an idea of what, sort of a synopsis of the whole story and put it to music for one of the songs, and it came out really cool. And then there are some scenes from Luna that are available for download, and yeah, you can check out a lot of what we do.
Now, how many of the actors from The Rite of Luna are in your Rite of Venus?
Principals, there's myself. I play Pan in Luna, and I will be playing Libra in Venus. Melissa Holm, who played Cancer in Luna, is playing Venus. And Daniel Christensen, who played Taurus in Luna, is playing Saturn in Venus. In fact, he and I have a tango that is just quite something. We went out and had it choreographed, just amazing. And those are the principals who are involved. Also, several of our fairies and fauns have been involved either on stage or off stage for part of the project.
So there's actually kind of a whole community building around the production of these.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's several of the people who have been involved with the production have later gone on to be involved with the OTO more and become part of our OTO community. A lot of the people who I brought in were not initially aware of or involved with the OTO. They were just people I knew, you know, sort of from the overall pagan community who had an interest and who liked the idea of doing musical theater.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been a nice way to introduce people to Crowley.
Excellent. Now, has there been any local coverage in any of your local media, newspapers or radio or anything like that?
Yeah, we've been on public access. We've done several promotional shows, pre-shows at particularly belly dance events, because, of course, we have all these belly dancers on the cast, and they love to go out and perform anyway, and so they've taken some of the original music and gone out and performed it in cabarets. And, but we've got some public access things that have gone on. We've gotten a little bit of coverage here and there, and, again, it just sort of grows slowly.
Great. Well, is there anything else that people should know about it?
Only that I'm really, really proud of this production, and I really hope that they get the opportunity to see it. We will actually be doing some of the music from this production and from Luna and from some of our other rites that we've already started writing music for at Noticon.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be showing up there, and that should be fun.
Fantastic.
We look forward to meeting everybody. So come up and say hi.
All right. Sounds great. Well, thanks again for being on the podcast and letting people know about what you're doing, and thanks for doing that in the first place. It's good to see this kind of work manifesting in the Thelemic community.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, and I really appreciate the work you do.
All right, thanks. Well, I'm sure we'll be in touch in the future. 93.
Thanks for being on the show again, John. And John has given us a little bit of the music that we talked about. So before going into the interview with Keith 418, I'm going to play about a minute's worth of the My Soul is an Enchanted Boat, or it's from Asia in Percy Shelley's Prometheus Unbound. So here's about a minute of that.
My soul
and thine doth like an angel sit beside a helm conducting it, whilst all the winds with melody are ringing. It seems to float ever forever upon that many winding river between mountains, woods, abysses of paradise, of wildernesses.
Thanks again, John. I appreciate you sending the music over, and the closing music is also going to be a song from The Rite of Venus. Now we're going to move into the interview with Keith 418. As I said, this is going to be a longer show than usual. So this is a longer interview with Keith. We're going to be talking for about 30 minutes, and we're going to be discussing the leadership of the OTO, how they got there, and kind of, you know, some of the other aspects of the Thelemic community. And then we go off into I don't want to say tangents, but kind of following where the discussion goes off in other areas and looking at class issues and how they have effects within the leadership. So, again, that's about 30 minutes, and those who find Keith's ideas and or voice annoying, feel free to fast-forward over that for about 30 minutes. Here he is.
We have on the phone with us Keith 418. Welcome back to the podcast, 93.
93, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's been a while since you and I talked, and there's been a lot going on in the Thelemic community. But one of the things that I keep looking at is the leadership. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on the leaders, and not necessarily how they any individual leader is performing per se, although that is important, but how these people got into the leadership positions in the first place. People spend a lot of time criticizing Hymenaeus Beta or Sabazius. I mean, I'm certainly guilty of that, but a lot of people are not looking at how these people got their positions in the first place, or even their predecessors, or how leadership develops in the Thelemic community or the occult community in general. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, I think there's a number of competing climacteric sort of conditions that create leadership, and I think as the Thelemic community has changed, it tends to self-select leaders and look at leaders in different ways. That's probably natural, but it also becomes problematic. And if you look back, there's a sort of architectural arrangement in which the people who were first attracted to Crowley tended to be, I would say the people attracted to the Grady era OTO tended to be people from the hippie milieu, very bohemian, sort of in rebellion against normative middle-class values. And although there were some exceptions to that, in general, those were the people who formed the leadership cadre around Grady. And because of this, the Grady-era people are often mocked, and their involvement at that point is often used to excuse problems and difficulties that the OTO is still having. I mean, I've seen emails from leaders, and I've talked to leaders who still blame their current problems on the Grady-era people. So you've got this sort of hippie, countercultural, very wild and woolly milieu with a lot of the associated behaviors that, you know, that we think of when we think of that group, transiting after a while, as that group goes through burnout and frustration and difficulties, sometimes due to their lifestyle, sometimes due to other factors, transitioning into a more middle class environment where people are seen as potential leaders because they meet middle-class criteria. They have a home that they own, that they have stable jobs, that their family lives aren't constantly collapsing, and they look like trustworthy, solid individuals. So my feeling is that the new leadership in the occult community tends to look more stable. And I'll confess, you know, when this leadership first began to make its move towards, you know, taking control of the organization, I thought it was great. I totally thought this was the future of the organization, that these people were going to kind of clean up the mess and the craziness that the hippies had created, and really work towards, you know, making the group stable and making it look more serious. And it looked that way for a while, and then, you know, I think we've seen that the problem is that good, solid, stable middle-class agents are good, solid, stable middle-class agents because they have good, solid, stable, middle-class agent values. And those values are not ones that predispose you towards experimenting with magic, learning a lot about Gnosticism on a practical level, and really embracing the more transgressive elements in Crowley's teaching. So a crisis began to develop where, while the middle-class leaders were in power, they had qualms and conflicts about the group and the teachings that they were in charge of. And that conflict, I think, is the fundamental one that you see in the order right now on the leadership level. And I think it sort of stalled the progress of the OTO. They're caught, as a friend of mine puts it, you know, part of the way up a mountain. I won't say halfway because I don't think they're halfway there yet, but part of the way up. They can't go any further up because that conflicts against their values. And they don't really want to go back down and admit the whole thing was a mistake and that they're not really into it anymore anyway. So they're sort of trapped there on the side of the mountain. They have a kind of shaky camp set up, if you'll enable me to continue the analogy, and they don't really know what to do. And I think that's sort of the frustration of a lot of people, is that they're saying, hey, come on, you know, you're the OTO, you're this group that, you know, says it's all about these things, you know, why aren't you moving forward, where's the progress, where's the plans, where's the goals, let's see the results. And they're, you know, sitting there going like, we don't really want to go either way.
Mm-hmm. Well, to kind of look at something in the middle class thing, though, and I don't want to get too far off this issue, but I think there's an important point there. You know, people hearing that are going to then turn around and look at things that you and I say about having strategic goals, about getting property, about having transparency in management and processes, about accountability for the leadership. They're going to look at those things and say, well, that's all very middle class, and that's something that you and I advocate. So they're going to say that we're kind of being hypocritical about that, and that we're criticizing the middle class, but yet all these middle class things that have made the middle class stable are things that we're appealing to.
Well, yeah, but again, and I don't discount that criticism, and I think it bears a great deal of thought and investigation, but the problem is that I don't think that it's wrong to want to harness middle class values and middle class skills to projects that may be inimical to the values that that middle class aspires to. I mean, you know, Lenin once said, the bourgeoisie will sell you the rope today you will use to hang them with tomorrow. And I don't think it's wrong for anybody to take the skills that they've learned in life and apply them to helping move the great work forward. So the idea that somehow because you've learned accountability or transparency or strategic planning, you know, in a middle class environment means that you can't apply that in the OTO seems absurd. The difficulty is that what we've seen is the middle class leaders suffer a sort of bizarre schizophrenic breakdown at a certain point where all of the skills that they used to become good middle class agents, they refuse to use in the OTO. I mean, this is one of the chief conflicts between, I think, yourself and the middle class leaders that once supported you as a fellow leader, in that you expected them to behave like middle-class agents when it came to the OTO, and rather than doing that, they started to make exceptions and say, well, you know, you might expect these sorts of plans and processes and procedures and, you know, uniform enforcement of policy and everything else in another kind of environment, but you can't expect it here. And so one of the ways of coping with their conflict is to turn the OTO into sort of a break from middle-class life, where it becomes a sort of respite from the sort of demands and accountability issues that they face in other circumstances. So when we say, why don't you apply the same sort of principles and ideas that you have in the rest of your life to the OTO, they say, well, that's not what the OTO is about. It's a place where we go to avoid those kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another source of the conflict. But ultimately, do you transcend your class problems by blowing them off or by moving through them? And if there is a better way of building the Blue Equinox model for the OTO that doesn't involve any of the things that we've talked about or discussed or suggested, then I'd like to see what it is. I mean, I could be hideously wrong. If strategic planning is something that's like completely deleterious, if transparency is a bad idea, if demanding more money from the members in terms of mandatory local dues, if hiking up the standards are these all awful ideas, and there's some like higher, more aristocratic method of constructing the OTO the way Crowley designed it and the way that the leaders themselves say they want it to look, then I'd be happy to look at that and even embrace it. But no one's offering that. Instead, mm-hmm. They're just retreating from the model and saying, well, you know, maybe down the line, many years hence, we'll actually own property.
So, yeah, you know,
is that a middle class response? The middle class got to be the middle class because they were homeowners and owned property.
Right.
Why doesn't the OTO take a more vigorous attitude about owning property? Well, if it did, it would have to be more rigorous and more responsible and accountable about every other part of itself. You know, someone once said, and I think I've said this before on the podcast, but it bears repeating, ambition that does not reckon with sacrifice results in neurosis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're saying they're ambitious about the Blue Equinox. Who's talking about the sacrifice? At no point have the leaders come to us and said, this is our ambition, here's the sacrifice we're expecting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very strange reflection of the Bush administration. I mean,
well,
here we are in war,
yeah.
And you know, and the sacrifices that George W. Bush asks of the United States is to continue shopping.
Right, they're giving tax cuts while the war is going on. Very weird, especially from, you know, the Republicans who used to be known as the balanced budget party, who were totally opposed to the idea of spending more than you brought in. The balanced budget amendment was a plank on the Republican Party platform, and Bush is blowing the deficit through the roof. But again, I think if people take the time to really study the reasons why Bush doesn't want to ask Americans to make sacrifices, they're going to see similar reasons as to why the OTO administration doesn't want to ask its members for money to publish the Crowley books or for more money in local dues. The same trepidation is there. If the Bush administration asked everybody to pony up immediately what the cost of the war was and didn't put it on the national credit card, so to speak, everyone would be opposed to the war and people, you know, would freak out and they know they wouldn't get anywhere. Well, if the OTO leader said, hey, look, you know, we're going to really build the Blue Equinox and buy property and take this really seriously and everyone has to pony up, then most of the members would quit. They just won't pay. And I'm not talking about the low-level members. A lot of them would probably stay. I'm talking about the upper degrees and the friends and buddies of the leaders. But getting back to the class issue, though, you know, you're looking at, like, how people become leaders in the OTO. If you show up at an OTO body and you own your own home and you have a stable job and you look like a good middle-class agent, they will try to promote you into leadership.
Yes.
This is, I mean, I've been amazed at the way some of my friends who fit this description have been offered leadership positions in the OTO when people barely know who they are.
They're first degrees.
They're like, we're going to put you in charge of the lodge. They're that desperate for middle-class agents. And in a way, it's understandable because the OTO, it doesn't want to screen out free riders and moochers. It has a real antipathy towards a sect-like environment. It wants a church environment. It needs people who have these resources and seem stable because they're surrounded often by people who don't have any resources and are very unstable. So you need to have these middle-class agents running the organization. And as we've seen, though, when you try to challenge middle-class values or when you, you know, take middle-class values too far and expect that the OTO will actually start buying property and taking itself seriously the way any other serious middle-class institution is run, there's objections and problems and screaming and yelling and, you know, all sorts of things. So.
Now, but let's go back before Grady. I think you can trace a lot of present dysfunction mirrored in past dysfunction. I mean, everything from the lack of planning in Germer's time, and some also from the lack of planning in Crowley's time, and by Crowley and the followers of Crowley. So it seems to me that there's a long pattern of a lack of planning, of dysfunction, of people not taking this seriously. And it seems to me that people are really going to have to look at these things and take them to heart and really come up with some different solutions. And one of the things that really bothers me is the way that people are moving away from actually looking at any kind of causes and conditions and determinants that are in the past for what is around today and are just looking for, you know, fingers to point, like what you're saying. The current leaders point, you know, just back to Grady's time.
A lot of them want to blame Crowley, too. I mean, a lot of people, you know, basically blame Crowley the way they blame their parents for their problems. He didn't plan well enough. He didn't...
And you know what? There may be truth to that, dot every I. But, I mean, we're talking about 100 years here. I mean, there's a lot that has happened in 100 years. Crowley's been dead now 60 years. Mm. So, you know, when are people going to start looking at, you know, even after 47, Crowley's dead, boom, done. So what are people going to learn from the last 60 years? What kind of diagnosis are they going to do? See, at a previous job I had, we would do a project. And the project could be anywhere between a 6-month project or a 2-year project, you know, from a budget of, you know, a few hundred thousand to a few million. But at the end of every project, we would do a post-mortem. We would look back. We would say, okay, what worked? What didn't work? How did these processes go? What can we improve so that the next time, et cetera, et cetera? We would go back and be self-critical. We don't see the people doing that today. They want to, as you pointed out to me in a previous conversation, they just want to point blame. The current leader is just like, oh, it's the fault of the previous administrator. Or, you know, it's low-level members saying, oh, it's the problem of this body master or this SGIG. They're not really looking at the bigger picture or doing any diagnosis, as you say.
You have to look at another component here, and the component is charismatic personality. You know, people are looking for stability. They're looking for a leadership that's going to provide them with the things that they want, which is, you know, a stable person who isn't a kook, isn't a maniac, who will pay the bills, who will take care of things, who will act responsibly, and who won't let things get out of control. And one of my friends pointed this out, that to a certain extent, the current leaders in the OTO really deserve a kind of praise for not letting things get off the hook. You know, we may not like the current state of the OTO, and we may see a lot of problems with it, but they haven't let it deteriorate into some sort of, like, Jim Jones-esque cult of total insanity. They have been pretty good at keeping a reasonable amount of control over the organization. And to that extent, you know, they get praise, and this is one of the things that I think people are looking for them to do. You've got this crazy, you know, pseudo-satanic, in quotes, group, and, you know, you've got leaders that are keeping a lid on things. But there's another dimension. People are also looking for charisma. They're looking for charismatic individuals with powerful personalities and exciting, wild ideas to stimulate them and inspire them. And so there's a balance. And a lot of times, those are the people look to for leadership. They want those people to lead them. They're attracted to those people. And so there's a dynamic going on. And if there's too much middle-class stability, it leads into boredom and boring Presbyterian church-like activity that excites no one and, you know, people drop out of. And if it goes in the other direction, well, it tends to blow up like Jack Parsons and go out of control in the other way. And you can look at both these leadership dynamics as being indications that people don't really understand the philemic material, that they're substituting either a middle-class daddy-father type or a wild and crazy pan-like figure. You know, but at no point are they actually taking responsibility themselves for their own direction and their own purpose. So, you know, they're foisting responsibility onto these other figures. And I think we need to look at that element to it as well.
Well, I mean, this isn't the first time that's happened. I mean, this is about as common in religious organizations as it gets. You've been talking about this recently in your blog. I mean, you cite, you know, from a friend of yours, Paul. I mean, Paul did this with Jesus. So you've got all of these people where Paul is saying to them, you know, follow me, I'll show you the way to Christ. And, you know, and it seems kind of odd to me that here you have this vicarious way to God through Jesus, but then you've got Paul saying, well, you know, to get to Jesus, you know, follow me.
Right. Well, again, I mean, I think that looking at this substitution, you know, are leaders that are genuinely bringing you to the reality of the Thelemic experience, or are they substituting for a reality that's too intense for you to face? And if you're somebody who really isn't committed to doing the incredibly difficult and dangerous work that it takes to master the Thelemic material, and we're not egalitarians. We know that most people are never going to attain with the system. It's not something that... If everyone could easily attain with Thelema, then the world would look vastly different than it does, and the OTO in particular would look vastly different than it does. In fact, it's very difficult. So if you're looking for somebody to take you to that very difficult place, that's one kind of leader. If you're looking for somebody to take you away from that kind of place and to make you feel better for not having gone to that kind of place or wanting to go to that kind of place, then that's another kind of leader. And unfortunately, I think that there's been a migration away from Crowley, which even some of the leaders in the OTO admit to. When they can't sell the books and when the members aren't that interested in Crowley, they'll admit, yeah, there's a migration away from Aleister Crowley. What they don't want to talk about is who's leading the migration. And oftentimes I think the migration away from Crowley is being led by leaders in the organization who themselves have a lot of conflicts with Crowley's teaching, especially with the Book of the Law, and who really, you know, want to provide some sort of occult, you know, substitute, which is, you know, warmed over secular humanism or sort of a liberal Unitarianism in exchange for the really transgressive and difficult parts of the Thelemic core materials. So you have to look and sort of test your leaders and say, are these people leading us to a challenge and to really difficult things, or are they leading us away from a challenge? And I think this is really where the Thelemic community's leaders are failing, because they have chosen to lead their members away from challenges rather than lead them towards challenges.
Well, I think that's also reflected in the occult community itself. I mean, as you've pointed out previously, there's kind of a lull in the whole occult, you know, community in general. There's a little activity here and there, but there's not a lot going on. You've got people, you know, getting together and doing their little business meetings and maybe doing some kind of personal ritual here and there. But, I mean, as a whole, the occult community is not producing material and activities and so forth like it was in the 60s and 70s and so forth.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think it's interesting to look at that lull and to see it and say, you know, what's really going on here? Why is this happening? And you know, why do we see such little meaningful occult activity going on? And, you know, you started that E-list, I chided you for not having really done too much with it, and you said, hey, look, there really isn't that much going on, and it's true. There really aren't that many exciting books coming out. There really aren't that many exciting communities working on this stuff. It's really a larger, almost occult biorhythm that we're seeing in the zeitgeist, where it's just at a low point. And it happens. I mean, it happened in the 1950s, for example. It's happened in other places. So I wish I had more of a line on why it was happening, but I don't.
In the 80s, you know, there in early 90s, there was this huge zine and occult newsletter thing. I remember when I started getting involved in the early 90s, I mean, there was just this enormous amount of zines and newsletters and stuff on bulletin boards and just people. I mean, I would say the majority of it was crap.
Right. Oh, yeah.
But it's not being done. I mean, you would think it would be even easier today with things like Publisher or even just web pages that have, you know, really good content that, you know, the crazy people who are making zines are putting out on web pages. But it's not there. You go to the Thelemic, you search on Thelema and start looking at these web pages, it's the same thing. They have the same graphics. They have the same dumb statements about, you know, who they are, and then they just do a bunch of reprints of Crowley. And they don't really, nobody's really creating anything.
Well, I think part of the problem is that it's difficult to produce meaningful work. It really is. It's not, the egalitarian myth that occultism is easy and that anyone can do it, or that Thelema can be anything you want, if it could be, and if it was like that, we would see a vastly different scene than we do. In fact, it's very difficult. It's not easy to produce meaningful material. And what people avoid looking at, and I think this is fascinating, is the way in which people pick up and leave the occult. You know, you've been involved in the community for a long time. I've been involved for over 20 years. And new people don't realize that the people around them in the occult scene right now will not be there 5 or 6 years from now. They won't be there 10 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these people come in, they seem really enthused and excited about it, they seem like it really matters to them, but after a while, they get tired of the fact that it's really much harder than they want it to be, and they give it up and they move on, and oftentimes they forget they were even involved. And it's fascinating for me to sort of see that process, and I liken it to somebody who tries to pound a square peg into a round hole for a while, and sooner or later gets tired of it and moves on to something else. And often the people who have stayed in the community for a long time, and this is a point a younger friend of mine raised, I thought it was very prescient, they stay there because there's really nowhere else for them to go. It's not that they've mastered the material, they just don't know where else to go. And this is kind of comical, it's kind of sad in some instances, but you know, where are the really fabulous, exciting, challenging occult thinkers and writers right now? I mean, we're just not seeing that.
Well, I'm wondering if it is a result of consumer culture, short attention span, and all of the distractions that are out there. You know, there wasn't a lot of strange or occult-like production outside of these communities in the early 90s and the 80s. In fact, it was shunned. I mean, you can think of the anti-satanic movement that was during the 80s. Today, you know, you don't have to go into occult groups or research it. You can just turn on the WB or whatever and see The Craft, or you can go out to, you know, some movie store and rent all of these occult-like movies and get your kind of strange fix from it, and you know, live vicariously through these characters who are involved in witchcraft or occultism or or demonic possession or whatever. I mean, think about when The Exorcist came out and how unique that was, or Rosemary's Baby, and how strange and fascinating that was. Those movies now are commonplace. So people,
yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it. I also think that there's so much information in the consumer culture right now, or just available to people via the internet, through Netflix, through TiVo, through cable, that they don't really have time to sort through the vast amount of popular culture that's available at a very small price. You know, it's not so much a matter of you know, affording a movie, it's affording the time to watch all the DVDs or movies you have. I mean, I probably have 50 DVDs at my house that I haven't seen. And it's not because I don't want to, it's because I just don't have the time. I have to sit down and really make the time to do it. And we're so busy, we work longer hours than we used to in America. You know, these are all contributing factors. But I tend to think that there is still other issues, because in other periods of time, there have been occult revivals and then periods where there hasn't been a lot of production or activity. And periodically, it comes back into fashion again. Periodically, people are attracted to it. And I don't discount the idea that there could be forces and powers operating deep below the surface that are controlling the appearance and disappearance of this kind of activity.
Well, then, what do you think, you know, assuming there's something that people could do or you know, influences other than those kind of the occult invisible hand, you might say, what do you think, you know, people can do if they're looking to have a
more
vibrant...
Well, I think the most important thing they can do is to really investigate this material on a personal level. I think that all of the great advances in occultism, from Crowley, even to people like Austin Osmond Spare, Jack Parsons, and others, came about because people were tired of a hands-off academic approach. They were tired of looking at everything theoretically and at a distance, and instead decided to immerse themselves as individuals as completely and utterly in the material as they could. And that's a huge risk. It's a huge risk whether there's an internet full of stuff available to you or no internet at all. It's a risk if you're a, you know, poor Jewish guy in a ghetto in the Middle Ages in the 1500s, and it's a risk if you're, you know, a disaffected stoner character in the 2000s in Los Angeles. It doesn't matter who you are, it's always a risk. And the people who take that risk and really, really look for a deep personal experience with the materials, those are the people who become productive, those are the people who become interesting, those are the people who become leaders, real leaders, and authentic leaders that matter and who last. The more you avoid that personal involvement and connection, the more you consign yourself to, you know, boredom and nothing. So that's my suggestion to people, is to really take a very, very personal interest and put a personal stake in it. And even if you don't attain everything that you want, you can still say, I gave it my all, I got really involved in it myself, I didn't just live it vicariously or through other people's work. It was something that I did. It was my experience, and you can own it in that unique way. And I think that the problem that we have in the community today is that there's almost a surfeit of ways, as you said, to vicariously live through it, whether it's watching a terrible sitcom or bad horror movie on TV, all the way up to, you know, reading bad beginner books by lame figures in the occult community who are trying to explain things to people rather than, you know, get them to do it themselves. So there's that, you know, problem as well. And I think that it's easier now for people to take that hands-off attitude. And you see this, I hate to say it, in the sort of academic approach to the occult, where no one talks about their personal experiences with it, everybody treats it as in a sort of distanced way, and, you know, you have people kind of almost competing to see how far they can remove their own experiences and personality from the material. So, you know, the more commitment people make to it as individuals, and the more they plunge themselves into it, and it's still scary and difficult to do. And the internet doesn't take away the scary and difficult part. It changes it, but it doesn't take it away. The risk and the danger is always going to be there. And the people who come through that risk and that danger will be authentic occult figures of import, and the people who refuse to do it will be losers who will not produce anything.
Well, I think that's a good point and a good place to end this conversation. So thanks again for being on the podcast, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thanks for having me, John. 93.
Thanks again to Keith for being on the show. I always enjoy our discussions, and from what I can tell, the majority of listeners do too. Now we're going to move into the interview with Freighter WIT, and that is about an hour long, and we get into a lot of really specific details in his book, his ideas about Enochian initiation, Enochian practice, and some of the technical aspects of it. And then we also get into some of the ideological aspects of kind of the underlying beliefs and have those beliefs manifest in the actual practice within it. And in particular, we get into kind of the religious or secular approach, or the psychological or non-psychological existence of entities and things like that. So here's the interview with Freighter WIT.
We have on the phone with us Freighter WIT. Scott, are you there?
I'm here.
Welcome to the podcast, 93.
93, thank you for having me.
You've released a book called Enochian Initiation, A Thelemite's Magical Journey into the Ultimate Transcendence. And when I first saw that you had this book, I thought it was going to be kind of a manual on how to do Enochian magic. And I was really surprised when I got it. And it was, you know, started reading it and everything, it was actually kind of your journal and your notes and your experiences going through the tables and talking to the seniors and talking to the kings and so forth. And I thought that was a really unique and different take. You know, this is more akin to kind of like Crowley's Vision and the Voice than some of the other books that are out there, are the how-to books. What kind of inspired you to put the book out in the first place?
Okay, well, I've been involved in occultism for the last 20 years, and I've practiced a number of different systems, primarily Hermetic Kabbalah. I'm a member of the OTO. I've been a member of an offshoot order of the Golden Dawn. I've been all through that. I've done a lot of Golden Dawn magic. What I found was that most books on magic are either a history or a listing of rituals and things like that. And what I've noticed is that while a lot of people that I've met enjoy reading these books, very few actually practice the rituals. And it seems to me that people, it just somehow didn't spark their imagination enough to get them going. So I thought that, well, maybe if people could understand the incredible results that they could get by practicing magic, it would inspire people to actually do the rituals and practice the magic rather than just reading about it and talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
I myself have been very inspired by Aleister Crowley's book, The Vision and the Voice, which is his series of visions operating the 30 ethers, which is one of the various systems of Enochian magic that John Dee and Edward Kelly developed, you know, in Elizabethan times. So I've been amazed by Crowley's personal experiences, and really, he's one of the few writers out there that will actually talk about his experiences. So that's what I wanted to do.
Now, unlike Crowley, who went through the 30 ethers, you went through the five tables, the four elementals, and or I guess the fifth spirit, or the table of union. And you went through and you talked to the various seniors, kings, and so forth of the various quadrants. Why did you decide to do that instead of doing the ethers? Because many, many, many people do the ethers and kind of replicate Crowley's work. And why did you decide to go through the quadrants?
Okay, well, as I describe in my book, I was involved in a magical workshop with a magical partner, and she and I had done a variety of work from Golden Dawn books, even some interesting work out of Cornelius Agrippa's three books of occult philosophy. It's interesting that while the Golden Dawn drew a great many systems of their magic from Agrippa's three books, they didn't get it all. So my magical partner and I wanted to really experiment and try some things that few people out there were doing. at one point, you know, the results that we were getting at the time were interesting but not really amazing. Nothing really seemed to break through to another reality, if you will, or another level of mind. So I had read about Enochian magic for a long time. I had read The Vision and the Voice several times, and certainly reading about Golden Dawn magic, I knew of the use of the watchtower system, which are four matrices of Enochian letters, and then there's a fifth tablet called the Tablet of Union, which has the four special divine names in Enochian that are used to control the four elemental tablets. And they had been used in Golden Dawn initiation, and I had just come out of a Golden Dawn-style order, an offshoot, if you will. Plus, I had received some initiation in the OTO, which takes after Freemasonry. So I thought, well, I'm on my own now, and I was the one running the workshop, so I thought, well, maybe I can take my initiatory experiences farther and get closer to the Golden Dawn egregore, if you will, or their group mind, and by using the Enochian tablets in a more direct way. Now, the Golden Dawn takeoff of John Dee's system is rather complex. They added a lot to the system, or I should say McGregor Mathers, who ran the order for most of its history, added a lot to the Watchtower system that wasn't there originally, namely making each square of these matrices of letters into a truncated pyramid, and there's a wide variety of symbols added to these squares, and so that each square of each tablet was made into an entire gestalt of symbols. This seemed very complex to me, and I know that John Dee's original intention was to use the tablets like others of his time had used magical tablets to draw the names of angels, you know, the names of various spirits. So that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to approach the 30 ether system like Crowley did because I felt that that was extremely advanced magic. I wanted to do something at a simpler, easier level. And, of course, at the time I had heard all the warnings, oh, Enochian magic is so powerful. If you just look at the tablets, you might evoke some of these entities and they wreak havoc on your life and all that stuff. People say these things about other potentially powerful system like the Goetia and various other medieval grimoires. I came to realize that these stories were exaggerated and they were mainly being told by teachers who had come out of the Golden Dawn who wanted to, I guess, on the one hand, protect people from themselves, but on the other, to kind of guide students in a particular path that they might not otherwise want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone believes that any one particular system of training is the best training. Different things work for different people, but there are those out there who want everyone to follow their way, and that's unfortunate. So a lot of exaggerated and negative stories have been told by people who should know better, I feel. So I felt free to approach the Enochian systems of magic with a completely free hand.
Okay.
So I chose the Watchtower systems to extend my personal initiatory experiences, but outside the order context, you know, outside of the Golden Dawn and outside of that paradigm or that setting, and work with it on my own. And the results that I got were amazing right off the bat, so I knew that I had finally struck the right track. And my magical partner completely agreed with me. With Enochian magic, we had really broken through our personal limitations in a way that no other system we played with and dealt with even came close.
Now, you mentioned further your initiation, and the book is called Enochian Initiation. What do you think the initiatory process was bringing you to? What you know, going through the tables that you did and calling the various entities, what was the initiatory process? I mean, if you look at, like, the Golden Dawn or the OTO initiations or AA or any of these orders, you know, they kind of have a fixed path that they're trying to initiate you up through. What was the Enochian initiation? What was it pushing you towards?
Right. Well, it's an interesting topic of conversation. See, originally I approached the Enochian Watchtower system in an open way. I wasn't after any kind of further initiation. I was just looking for a powerful system of magic that could help me to break through to a more profound level of vision, a deeper level of consciousness than I had done previously. I had, prior to this, I had done several attempts at what they call self-initiation, where it's just you, your ritual, and your various paraphernalia to try and bring yourself to a higher level of magical function, a more intense level of vision and contact with entities, you know, beyond the physical. But I had never gotten very far. What I found that after several experiences evoking the seniors of the tablets was that I started to deal with the issues that had come up during my personal initiatory experiences within the group context that I had been describing, you know, the Golden Dawn style and the Masonic style initiations, which, you know, are group initiations. They're the instituted mysteries, as they're called. But here I was on my own, and for the first time, I had found something that actually helped me to deal with some of the issues that had been raised on my initiatory training in the orders.
Mm-hmm.
But here I was on my own. So what I'm trying to say is that I began to succeed on my own with things that before I had only been able to deal with in the group context.
Okay.
And so I had come to realize that these Enochian entities were continuing my initiatory process.
Okay. So where do you think, you know, at the end of this process, at the end of the cycles that you went through, you know, after you did the second round on the table of union and everything, where do you think you ended that process? I mean, obviously it's an ongoing process, but I mean of that cycle.
Right. It's hard to describe. In more general terms, what happened was that there was a certain level of consciousness that I was being introduced to, a certain level of intelligence that was developing within me, kind of like a seed was planted and it sprouted and it grew to fruition. There's a particular species of consciousness that I had been able to attain, and really the climax of the whole working was the second evocation of the Fire King on the Fire Tablet, and I broke through to a grand new level of operation that I had never dreamed of, and as I describe it in my book, the experience was so powerful, it actually extended its influence 17 years into my past. The 17 years prior to this experience, I had had a spontaneous vision completely out of the blue. This was before my magical career even began. I had been doing a lot of reading at the time, but I hadn't actually practiced any magic, but suddenly I had this vision of a great, wonderful hawk of blue fire, like it was sky blue colored fire, but against a night sky. But at the time, 17 years prior, it seemed very far off. Mm-hmm. And I heard it call to me. I had never heard that sound in my life beforehand. I can only describe it as a great cry of the hawk, and it just seemed to resound through just spaces beyond my imagination at the time. And it lasted for a few seconds, and then it ended. Well, 17 years later, I was evoking the King of Fire, which is the highest in the hierarchy of the tablets, you know, the mm-hmm. Watchtower tablets that we're talking about. And it was right up close. The hawk of sky blue colored fire was right there, right in front of me, not only in my mind, but I could feel its presence in front of me coming out of the tablet, and I could feel that connection 17 years in the past. And it was just so overwhelming an experience. Just, there are no words to properly describe the intensity, but that was a real climax to a state of being that's truly beyond space and time, a realm of pure energy that can only be described as flames within flames within flames. That's not a good way to describe it, but it's, like I said, this is such a transcendent reality that I'm talking about that there's no proper way to describe it. So I think that was the climax of that whole initiatory process. Of course, the word initiation simply means to begin something. And in a magical context, it means to begin a new stage on a magical curriculum. That's the value of the Enochian tablets, because they are divided among the elements. And the Golden Dawn, in their initiatory system, had an order of grades that charted the elements from earth, air, water, fire, and then to spirit. So that's the order that I was using them. That's the order in which I approached the tablets. And so I felt with each new tablet, it was beginning a new stage of my initiatory process. And it was completely outside a group context. There was just myself, sometimes my magical partner, and my magical paraphernalia, in this case, the elemental tablet of fire. And so this was an apex of my whole life that was just amazing. And even that, I guess, occurred in 2004. And here it is about 3 years later, and I'm still trying to more completely ascend to that level of operation. It's amazing the type of time paradox that magic can take you through. And other people have told me their experiences with this idea of feeling the effect of a ritual before you actually perform it. Mm-hmm. Now, in this case, I can't help but be reminded of a series of science fiction movies that came out of the 90s featuring this evil character called Death, D-E-T-H, and their technology was that they could send the psyche of a person back in time and inhabit the body of someone in that prior time rather than sending the whole person back in time. So that's an idea that's been around in the science fiction genre for a while. But with magic, I actually experienced it, or at least a piece of it.
One of the things that I've noticed, and you kind of emphasize this a lot at the beginning of your introduction, and then within the first part of your journal, where you see the entities as not external beings, not some kind of etheric entity that is outside of yourself. You see them as part of your mind or psyche, or consciousness, or subconsciousness, so forth. and that you also approach this in a non-religious format. So, you know, more of kind of a secular aspect of this is not a religious external being like real angels or real demons or real gods or whatever, but this is more of a psychological process where, you know, you're isolating certain aspects of your mind or consciousness, externalizing them to deal with them. Why do you have that perspective on this? Since you kind of go into it a little, but what is your background that you're pulling into that, and was the system enforcing of that, or did it kind of push you into seeing it in a different way?
Well, what happened in my experience is that since early childhood, I've always had the consciousness that humanity had just entered a new age. This is where all of the old institutions, the old beliefs, the old styles of thinking had been shuffled around and many times replaced by something new. In particular, I felt that religion had, in its traditional forms, had become obsolete. I grew up in a Jewish household, but I've never expressed any interest in the Jewish religion. I know that it refers to writings, the Bible, the Torah, and various other of these writings that are very ancient and very much of the old age, if you will. I felt that now was the time to break free of all of that and to establish a whole new style of spirituality. And this spirituality was very much based on individuality. It was up to the individual to explore his or her own psyche. I had always believed that the way to discover divinity, any kind of higher reality or more blessed reality, is to journey through your own psyche and reach to the heart of your own being. As an old song from the 60s goes, take a journey to the center of your mind. I always felt that that was the way to go. I had also been very much inspired by the revolution of the 60s counterculture, their idea of fusing a lot of different cultures, old and new, to develop something specific for the individual. I understood that this as part of the early age, the early part of the new age, that there was a lot of revolution going on, a lot of upheaval, and I very much wanted to be a part of that. It just felt instinctual to me to establish something new. And I also saw how fanatical some people could be in dealing with the old religions. Some people just went crazy with this kind of thing. In every religion, you know, no religion is immune to this kind of thing. I felt that something new was in the offing, if you will, and I very much wanted to be a part of it. Now, I also understood that a part of this revolution was the scientific revolution. And here, certain answers to very old questions, such as how did the universe come to be? How did humanity come to be? What was the nature of nature, so to speak? And science had come up with some very different answers than in the old religions. The advantage of science, of course, is that they could prove what they were talking about by experiment. And these experiments could be repeated anytime, anywhere, and you could achieve similar results so that you could really develop a realistic picture of what's going on rather than just relying on faith in some transcendent being. Now, I'll also say that, you know, growing up with a Jewish identity, if you will, even though I never got involved in the religion, I always understood that ethnically I was Jewish. And I've learned about the persecutions, the Holocaust, and World War II, and things like that. And it always seemed to me that, you know, how could people mindlessly believe in things that they couldn't see or prove to exist, and so many bad things had happened, how can you believe in anything like that anymore? So, you know, my faith never existed. It just, the facts of nature, the facts of history just didn't jive with the story that the traditional religions give.
Mm-hmm.
And the very fact that there are so many religions in the world, you know, how can any of them be correct, which would involve all the others being incorrect? Also, the what sectarianism involved in so many of the religions of the world, and the bitter struggles and violence that occur between different sects of the same religion, as well as the battles between religions, it just seemed to me to discredit the entire religious paradigm. So I always wanted to stay as far away from that. Now, flash forward to the point when I was 18 years old, I had come to California and to join in the counterculture, whatever was left of the counterculture of the 1960s. And while the original movements of the 60s had kind of moved on, what I discovered was the occult scene. And I had started reading some occult books by various authors. But with Aleister Crowley, I really felt an intimate connection. And reading the Book of the Law, which is the primary holy book of Crowley's religion of Thelema, it just set off a complete revolution in my life. It was exactly what I was looking for. I had joined in with a new tradition that was really clearly pointing the way forward into the new age. Now, Crowley, being a Victorian Englishman, he uses the word eon instead of age, but they're synonyms. So Crowley's new eon was exactly what I had been feeling all my life. So there was an instant rapport with Crowley and his ideas. Now, Crowley wanted to bring a more rationalist and psychological bent to magic. The traditional medieval ceremonial magic was very much based on the old religious paradigm. God was real, seated in heaven somewhere, and his angels surrounded him. All of that was considered to be real. But in the modern scientific paradigm, a lot of that is understood as essences within the mind, that these aren't so much literally real creatures, but human ideals. They were archetypes in the collective unconscious, things that many people had believed in for a very long time, and that sets up patterns in the group mind, the collective unconscious. And through the use of magic, you can draw on the collective unconscious and really make inroads to your own deep subconscious. It's the way to a higher state of being, a higher state of mind. This seemed to me to be more realistic than a completely faith-based, literal religious paradigm, which I had never believed in at any time. So I very much agreed with what Crowley was trying to do, and so I've tried to set up a whole new paradigm based on not only psychology, but physics, quantum physics as well, in order to explain what's really going on. See, in the process of magic, you contact that deep level of consciousness, the unconscious archetype, as we've been describing, and then through your ritual actions and your power, you begin to project that psychic energy into physical reality. Once that power enters physical reality, it can take on a life of its own. This is a thought form becoming real and quasi-physical, if I may coin a term. And once it's reached that level, it takes on a life of its own, and you can interact with it as if it were another person or another entity that you're talking with. Now, this is certainly a great metaphor for dealing with aspects of your deep unconscious, but I think that there is reason to believe that something in physical space begins to manifest as you perform your evocation.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question of, are the spirits real? Are they just wish phantasm? You know, the answer changes as the process of magic continues. I very much think that there is a link between mind and body and mind and the physical world, and you can utilize that inherent connections to cause patterns to manifest. So I think that the modern scientific paradigm of magic is much more compelling than the ancient religion-based paradigm. I think that there is science to really enforce and prove that it is possible for a human being to extend their powers, to extend the powers of their mind beyond simply personal content and interact with the physical world in a more intimate way. So this is what I have wanted to do with my magic. I think it's fully in line with what Crowley was doing. And so that's why I rejected that whole religious paradigm to begin with.
But are you so sure that that's Crowley's position, that they don't exist?
Well, it's not that they don't exist, it's that they exist in the collective unconscious. See, Crowley addressed this question many times in his writing. I think his clearest exposition can be found in his Essay on the Astral Plane. This is Appendix 3 of Magic in Theory and Practice, which many Crowley enthusiasts have read. And Crowley says that there are two main paradigms of dealing with these magical spirits. There's the religious paradigm that views that these things are literally real, existing on their own plane of existence, and can be drawn to you through your magic. And the other paradigm is the psychological paradigm, which I've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Which
I've been describing. Now, what Crowley says in this essay is that it doesn't really matter what you believe. Believe one way or another, it's up to you. Just do the magic, get the results, write them down, and that's what you need to deal with. Now, something else that Crowley wrote in his translation of the Goetia, he said outright, the goetic demons are parts of the human brain.
Mm-hmm.
That's straight out of Crowley's recension of the Goetia.
Mm-hmm.
In other of Crowley's writings, he asserts that the spirits are real. His holy guardian angel, which he called Iwas, he referred to it as a praetor human existence.
Right.
That Iwas was real in an overt way, like you and I are real.
Right. Let me read you a
Crowley
paragraph
was kind
here.
Of ambiguous.
Well, tell me if this is ambiguous. It seems to me much simpler to say that these angels are real individuals, although living in a world whose laws we have no conception, and that in order to communicate with us, they make use of the symbolic forms appropriate, employ, in short, a language of the astral plane. That's
okay.
Out of Magic Without Tears.
Right, right. Again, Crowley wrote different things for different people, and he certainly, ultimately in different places, Crowley espoused both views, the psychological view and the literal view. And so you can point and choose whatever, you know, you'd like to follow. It seems to me that the literal paradigm doesn't make sense. I don't see why a certain symbol, a certain design on a piece of paper should have such virtue as to reach into the astral plane and attract the attention of beings who obviously have a life of their own and are concerned with their own affairs why they should be interested in human affairs to start with really escapes me. I don't believe in the literal view at all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that it's true. I don't believe in religion. I don't believe in the literal existence of God. There's never been any kind of physical proof. I think that the power is the human power. And in the new eon, it's always been my understanding that so much of the unusual phenomena that people have reported are more easily understood as tricks of the mind, but also an uncontrolled mind working to actually influence material events. That, to me, is a more realistic viewpoint. Now, there are other Thelemic writers that also espouse this psychological viewpoint. In particular, Lon Milo Duquette espouses this. I'm reading his recension of the Goetia, which he calls the Illustrated Goetia.
Mm-hmm.
And he also views the demons as parts of our own mind, which we can then make real to do things for us. And in that process, we undergo a psychological healing. And that healing process then influences material events and makes a person ready to receive whatever it is thereafter. I think this is a much more realistic and probable way of viewing things.
Well,
I just don't see how these markings on paper could reach to a whole other plane of existence. I don't believe that there are entities who obviously have their own life and concerns who would be constantly listening for them to be called. That to me reinforces the whole religious paradigm that humanity is the center of existence and everything else is geared toward benefiting humanity.
Okay, well, let's move on to some of the technical aspects. And you said that the first part of your book is your journal.
Right.
And then the second part, the appendices, that have all of the technical details of how you went about your rituals. It has copies of the tables, the pronunciation, and you do mention that there's the two different types of pronunciation. You're doing the more kind of direct pronunciation, and then you also mentioned kind of the Golden Dawn pronunciation, which Crowley used and is in that he published in Gems. What is it, Liber Chanach? He's got all the Hebrew kind of vowels that have been added to the consonants. Now, an example of you've got the suggested phonetics listed here. You also have the Enochian. One thing that I did notice, though, is the tables that you use have the Enochian letters on them versus the English letters. Is there a particular reason? Did you find the Enochian letters were more effective? Or was that what you had available to you?
Well, what I wanted to do was to cut across the Golden Dawn complexity and approach John Dee's magic more in the way that John Dee did it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, John Dee didn't have the pyramid system like the Golden Dawn had. And from what I've learned from various teachers that I have gone to is that John Dee pronounced the Enochian words as if they were English words.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so you can add vowels as if they were English words to make them pronounceable. Now, what the Golden Dawn did was make every single letter its own syllable.
Right.
Now, it makes sense to do that with Hebrew when most words are 3, 4, or 5 letters long, but when you're dealing with Enochian words, they can have many more letters, and so it really lengthens the time it takes to utter an Enochian call when you do that. It seemed to me as too concocted to do it that way. I wanted to approach the magic in a simpler way, and so like John Dee, I just pronounced the Enochian words as if they were English words, and it makes it, I'm able to put more emphasis on words, and I have a recording of Aleister Crowley doing the Enochian, the
right.
first Enochian call.
Yeah, the recordings have him doing the first and second key.
Right, right. Yeah, there are 48 calls, which is yet another system of Enochian magic that Dee and Kelly developed. There's quite a few of them. Dee and Kelly did a great deal of work in their time, and they've left us quite a rich tradition. But in focusing more on the usage of the Enochian language, I wanted something that I could really put a lot of power into.
Mm-hmm.
Crowley's pronunciation of the first and second call, sometimes they're called keys, it's a very long, sonorous kind of sound. I wanted something that I could really project my voice into and really try and make the space around me shake or to give me that sensation. And so I wanted to be able to utter the words faster and more powerfully and with more emphasis. And that's what I've been able to do. So I much prefer the way Dee did approach the Enochian language than the way the Golden Dawn and Crowley did. Now, as far as why I use the Enochian letters instead of the English letters was kind of the idea of the barbarous names of evocation. If you're uttering something that you don't quite understand and that looks and sounds very unusual, very arcane, it tends to have a more intense magical effect than if you're using something more familiar. And having worked with the Enochian letters on my tablets, I can say from direct experience that the shapes of the Enochian letters have a profound effect on the psyche as well as the language itself. So I think it helps to use the actual Enochian alphabet rather than converting them into their English letter equivalents.
Well,
I created my tablets using Microsoft Excel, mm-hmm. interestingly enough. As it turns out, Microsoft Excel is the ideal product for making any kind of magical
table.
Tablet.
Yeah. But, I mean, going back to Dee, I mean, his is in English, though. He didn't use the Enochian letters.
Well, it's interesting. Dee never much used a lot of his magic. There's no record of Dee actually using the ether system. He didn't
mm-hmm.
use the watchtower system too much. From what Lon teaches, Dee and Kelly received a number of different magical systems, and just as they were about to actually employ these things, they split up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was left to later generations and later centuries to actually employ them. So,
well, I just mentioned that because you seem to be more of a Dee and Kelly traditionalist, which I think is fine and great. And if you go to like a True and Faithful Revelation, you see the watchtowers listed there in English, and then but then you use them in the Enochian. So I was just kind of curious on why. And so you're looking to do the more of the using kind of the differentness or the strangeness of that to get the different psychological states to kind of put you in a different kind of, maybe I don't want to use the word sacred or anything, but definitely a different mental space.
Right. Well, I like to use the word arcane. The
okay.
Enochian font is most definitely arcane, and what I've done in approaching Enochian magic is to take elements of Dee's operation and elements of the Golden Dawn operation and to synthesize my own system that works very well for me.
Mm-hmm.
My hope in writing this book, as I've said, is to encourage people to take up the practice of Enochian magic, and not so much you do exactly what I've done, but to develop their own style of practice like I've done, and to get results that are good for them. I'm not trying to set up new standards or tell people what to do. I'm just trying to inspire people to take up the system and develop their own syntheses like I've done.
Well, let's talk about the invocation ritual that you use in the back, because you do something that very few people do, and you give, you know, very clear, very straightforward, very direct instructions saying, this is what I said, this is what I did, and, you know, and I think that's fantastic, because you get a lot of ambiguity from people, and like, well, you know, you kind of do this, kind of do that, but you're like, no, you know, the opening is this, the preparation's that, the evocation's this, the closing's this, you say this, you do this. Where did you kind of put that all together from? Your various Golden Dawn background, readings of the Ian Kelly, other people that you've worked with, maybe readings or working with Lon Duquette. Where did you kind of synthesize that from?
Okay, a lot of it comes from my group magical experiences, and also the text of the Golden Dawn rituals that can be found in Israel Regardi's book, The Golden Dawn. The core of my opening is what's called the opening by Watchtower, and I adapted Israel Regardi's opening of the Watchtower that's written in a book called Ceremonial Magic. I understand it's out of print right now, but that has a fairly straightforward, instructions on how to open the tablets by Watchtower, or how to open the temple by Watchtower, and how to get the tablets ready for use. And so I adapted that to my own purposes, and certainly being inspired with the Golden Dawn system, I began with banishing, purification, consecration, and then for invocation, I use the opening of the temple by Watchtower, and then I do the circumambulation. So I'm taking a basic Golden Dawn format and adapting it to my own needs. And I put in little speeches from the oracles of Zoroaster as far as what to say before you do your purification of the quarters and the consecration of the quarters, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the main body of the ritual, it's simply a matter of using the call attributed by the Golden Dawn to that tablet and then calling the senior. I don't use the type of circle and triangle system that can be found in the Goetia. These aren't demons, these are angels. And my conception of the difference between demons and angels is that demons are an aspect of your subconscious, of the lower unconscious, of the various atavisms, functions of consciousness that were in use thousands or even millions of years ago, and that demonic evocation, you tap into that atavism in the collective unconscious, and then you project that enhanced psychic energy into physical reality in your triangle. With angels, these are aspects of your superconsciousness, and I'm using the word superconsciousness very much in the way that Aldous Huxley used it in his essay, Doors of Perception. It's the idea that there is, each human being exists in an oversoul, that there's a greater consciousness in which the individual exists as but a part. And with superconsciousness, that is an excellent initiatory principle. That's what can take you to new places. That's what can expand your horizons and really give you a psychedelic experience. And I write this overtly in my book, my visions of these angels and the different states of consciousness, the different visions that they helped to spawn in me, to initiate in me, is very much a psychedelic experience. There's a lot of similarities between what I have gone through and reports of people like Timothy Leary and John Lilly. Leary and Lilly, of course, were psychologists, and they viewed the mind as essentially a biocomputer, and their various methods, some of which are illegal now, were meant to develop the kinds and states of consciousness that I found myself getting from the Enochian angels.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, my own personal paradigm, I feel, is very much reinforced by the fringes of the scientific community as well as the psychological community.
Now,
I'm very much involved in the psychological view of things, and so I've approached the work of people like Timothy Leary and John Lilly with great interest, and I think I've been able to accomplish with ceremonial magic with what others have done with the use of psychedelic drugs, at least to an extent. And of course, ceremonial magic is not illegal, whereas psychedelic drugs are illegal.
Right, right.
So I think I have found my way into the new age, into the psychedelic experience in a legal way. If not quite socially acceptable, still it's a legal way.
Well, you know, the socially acceptable thing, you know, that's less of a concern, I guess, than the experience itself. But
oh, definitely, definitely. But I'm not dealing with things that could get me thrown in jail for 10 years.
That's correct. I mean, there certainly could be risks, I guess, of psychological impacts like there are with psychedelic drugs, but at least with the temporal legal system, you're not going to have any problems, at least
right, the
not right now.
Bang down my door because I'm practicing ceremony.
Exactly.
At least not yet.
Not yet. Well, you mentioned, you know, some of the sources that you've used, and in your book, you actually, in your bibliography, talk about a few books. And one of the things I wanted to kind of, you know, pick your brain is about, like, what books did you use to look up things? Like, you mentioned a number of times in your book, the Jeffrey James book, The Enochian Magic of John Dee. So I guess that was a book that was, you know, very useful to you. You also mentioned the Zalewski book. Is that the book that you used to look up the various angel names or senior names, king names, and so forth?
Well, actually, I didn't use it for quite that purpose. I had gone to a series of classes held locally on Enochian magic, and I have very detailed notes from that class as far as the names of the various hierarchies of angels involved in the tablets, so I was able to use class notes for that. I used the Jeffrey James book and the Pat Zalewski book more in the way of verification, to view what some other people had done, what the Golden Dawn had done, just to complete my understanding of Enochian magic and what things like Dee and Kelly had done, what various people in the Golden Dawn had done. Like I said, my primary source is Regardi's works, The Golden Dawn and Ceremonial Magic. Once I perfected my ritual, I was able to use my class notes to, you know, to learn the names of the seniors and the kings that I was wanting to approach, and to draw it from there. Certainly for the color correspondences, I was able to turn to to 777, which is Aleister Crowley's book on the Kabbalah, and it also has something called the Tables of Correspondences, which tell you what colors, what stones, plants, animals, all these things, mm-hmm. how they relate to each other, how they relate to the Tree of Life in the 10 Sephiroth and the 22 paths. And interestingly, I have quite kind of in an unrelated note, I've put the tables of correspondences from 777 into a computer program that I call the Computerized Grimoire, and that's available for sale on the internet. It's an easy-to-use interactive computer program that anyone can use, and I've solved a lot of the ambiguities in Crowley's tables. It's a great magical resource. I've used it to help me in my own ritual, and I think anyone can as well. It can be found at magic.nfshost.com.
Okay.
Magic is spelled with a K. So if people are interested in taking a look at that website, they can see some screenshots of.
Sure, we'll definitely put a link to it in the show notes.
That'd be great.
Did you have access to any other D books or like a True and Faithful Revelation or anything else? Any of the other manuscripts?
I have True and Faithful Relation, but ultimately I found it unreadable. It's couched in Elizabethan English, and I really have a hard time with that. Also, the printing that I have, the F's look like S's, and it just proved to be too difficult to use.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, like I said, Dee and Kelly didn't work too much with the elemental tablets or the 30 ether system. They worked a lot more with something called the Heptarchia, which is sort of planetary tablets, whereas the Watchtower system is the elemental tablets. And, of course, the ethers are kind of like shells of an onion that surround the Watchtower system.
Mm-hmm.
But the Heptarchia has what's called the Benorum tablets, and they're a whole different set of tablets. And they're meant to call up planetary angels, completely different from what's happening in the Watchtower system. Dee and Kelly did a lot more work with those.
Okay. Well, if somebody wanted to get a copy of your book, where would they go to?
Well, they could go to Amazon.com or Borders.com or BarnesandNobles.com.
Okay, so this is like a very available book.
Yeah, it's on the internet. You can use any book search. Anathema Books online featured a blurb on my book. And, with Amazon.com, there's a number of reviews of my book, including a review by Lon Duquette.
Okay.
So people can read those reviews in trying to decide whether they want to buy it.
Okay, well, I definitely will then put a link to it from to the Amazon site. And, we could definitely go on for hours on this, but we're kind of getting short on time. But I just really want to stress that I think it's great that you included with this not just the section, very specifically of what your practice was, but also, the journal aspect of this, because there's not a lot of people talking about what their results are, and you're putting it kind of, right out there, front and center for people to read and go through and judge and apply this themselves, and I think you should be applauded for that, regardless of what any kind of results that you get that somebody could then turn around and say, oh, this is just personal. But maybe it is. And maybe that, can be the inspiration for people to go out and do it themselves.
Yes, that's what I'm hoping. And, I record my mistakes as well as my successes. I record the disasters that I went through as well as my breakthroughs. So I wanted to give as open and honest a chronicle of what I've done as I possibly could. Even the mistakes and the disasters were worthwhile. In the long run, I'm in a much better place than I was when I started, And, you know, when you make a mistake, you suffer the consequences, but then you learn from it and move on, and you're better off for it. Now, I'd like to also mention that there's an ebook version available.
Oh, okay.
And that can be found on the Outskirts Press website. If someone goes to outskirtspress.com/Enochian initiation as one word, they can find the listing for my book, and there's an ebook edition available.
Okay, and I'm assuming that's significantly more cost effective than the $18.95.
Oh, yeah, the cost of the book, where the retail price is $18.95. Of course, with Amazon.com, there's always better bargains you can get from that. But the ebook is $5.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, that's well within the financial reach of almost anybody who wants to get the information.
Right, right. Some people like to have a book in their hand when they read it. Others prefer reading on the screen. So both editions are available.
Great. Well, I will have links to all of that, and I really appreciate you taking the time and coming on the show and talking about your experiences. There's a lot of listeners who email and ask about Enochian and ask about you know, various magical practices and getting ideas and advice on what they can do. So I thought it was a great way to kind of not only go over a lot of the details of one person's Enochian practice, but also highlight, you know, some results from that. You know, you produced a book from it. No, not many people are doing that. So, you know, I wanted people to know about it. So thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you for giving me this opportunity to promote my ideas.
All right. Well, if there's anything else we can do, let us know. And thanks again.
Thank you.
93.
Thanks again to all of my guests. I think it's wonderful that you were able to come on the show. And again, it's been 2 months, so I hope this podcast wasn't too long for you. I hope to get another one out soon. No promises when, but as soon as I can. And until then, keep the messages coming. The closing music, again, is from John Sewell's production of The Rite of Venus. And this song is called Adorations. Thanks again. Love's the law, love under will.